Abandoned townhouses with bricked-in windows are a common sight in downtown Baltimore. What once were family-filled neighborhoods are now empty because of blight and drugs. Another fact residents live with is their city's incarceration rate, one of the highest in the country. But as NPR's Jamie Tarabay reports, a pilot project that brings former offenders together to save these buildings may change that.
For anyone who's seen the HBO series The Wire, it's a familiar sight.
A lot of clothes, like, matter of fact, I'll show you right here.
Neil Joseph steps down to the lower level of a three-story townhouse on North Calvert Street in downtown Baltimore.
There's some crack vials and stuff in the corner here. There might even be some crack in this one. They didn't get all of that.
And he would know. 45 years old with bulging biceps, Joseph was once an addict. He says he's been clean for 14 years now. Standing in the midst of an abandoned crack den with smelly mattresses and empty liquor bottles, he now only sees a room that needs cleaning.
You look out the window, you see all the stuff that we threw out. You know, a lot of clothes and old furniture.
Joseph and eight other men are clearing this house as part of a program run by the Safe and Sound campaign. It's a non-profit organization working with the mayor's office. It hires ex-cons to deconstruct buildings, taking them apart piece by piece. All the men serve time for drug offenses.
To make it short, I was the over-the-road truck driver, and I was pretty much like transporting some marijuana from Arizona back to New York. Very lucrative, but got caught, so ended up doing a five-year prison sentence for that.
Some, like Donnie Wilson, are repeat offenders. He spent 35 of his 55 years in prison for drug and nonviolent crimes. The program teaches the men occupational health and safety. They get certified to work with hazardous material. Wilson says that gives them skills for the future.
Yes, I'm happy. I mean, it's a good paying job, working with good guys, good crew. You know, good boss.
The men are taking a breather on this steaming hot day, drinking water from a cooler, sitting on the doorsteps trying to stay out of the sun. It's over 100 degrees in the shade, and they've been working since 7 a.m. John Friedel from the Safe and Sound campaign says these guys know that dealing drugs makes a quicker buck, but they've been there and done that, and now just want to work.
If there were any of that sort of subtext thinking going on with the guys of, oh, it's too hot, it's horrible, it's grunt work, it's not good, I think they would have broken by now or not showed up. We've had perfect attendance every day.
The men are visibly proud as they talk about their work in deconstruction, but they all stress that it needs to continue. 600 abandoned houses in this area are coming down as part of a redevelopment bid, and Friedel hopes his program gets some of that work. Friedel says demolition might be cheaper, but in the long run, deconstruction provides more jobs and is better for the environment.
You really should use the brick, you should use the beams, you know, we can repurpose these materials. It really becomes cost neutral.
It gives these men the chance to work in a job market that is lean and not looking to hire ex-cons, and in their own neighbourhoods. Gary Maynard, the State Secretary for Correctional Services, says the people who live here were willing to give the program a chance.
This is the first community that was really wanting to reach out to members of their own community who were being released from prison. So we found that part of it very attractive.
23-year-old Troy Pratt says he remembers when this neighborhood was filled with families having cookouts.
I just want to see it back like it used to be, like 4 or 5 years ago. Everybody living in houses. Right now, they all vacant.
He spent 9 months in jail for selling drugs in this very same area. It was the only work he knew. Now, he says, that's changed. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
Now to a particular form of communication, deal-making. In Silicon Valley, there's a small restaurant where big deals are made. It's called Bucks. Over pancakes and coffee, perhaps, as some of the most famous internet companies hammered out their first funding deals there. John McChesney visited the restaurant and sent this report.
When you pull up in front of Bucks in the rural but very rich village of Woodside, There's nothing to suggest that this is one of the most important business venues in the country. A small white sign on an unassuming one-story redwood building is all that announces the place. But inside, the story's different. The place is packed on a Thursday morning, and many tables bristle with laptops and iPhones. That's appropriate, says owner Jameis McNiven, because Bucks was one of the first public Wi-Fi hotspots in the nation.
Thursday is sort of a peak day. Partners' meetings are on Monday, and Friday everybody takes a three-day weekend, so...
Gordon Haight and his sometime business partner Danny Ascindi are meeting over breakfast. Haight casts a seasoned eye over the room.
Like on this table over here, you have two guys on their Blackberries. I know this table over here, the guy on the right is selling, the guy on the left is buying. I know people in the other room are doing a pitch right now. This is an investor, and I need to take the call. Excuse me.
People are lined up for seats, and the place is humming with conversations. McNiven is pleased.
It's after 9, and we're still full, which is good for us. A year ago, it started to really drop off. We did see a lot of people running for cover, but everybody seems to be back.
Some people see Bucks as an informal barometer of business, a meeting place for money and innovation on the bleeding edge of the economy. Dave Cogleiser, a venture capitalist who invests in clean technology, has been coming here for years. He says a year ago, a lot of fear was holding back investments.
But for the last 6 months or so, we see a lot more activity, see a lot of great business plans, and see a lot more promise for the future and the overall markets.
Opened in 1991, Bucks' rise as a deal-making diner coincided with the rise of the Internet in the 1990s. And according to McNiven, his restaurant has some serious bragging rights.
Hotmail was founded right here. Netscape had their early meetings in the back room. Tesla was founded here. PayPal got funded here.
Stanford students Jerry Yang and David Filo pitched Yahoo here in 1994. McNiven chortles as he recalls the hapless venture capitalist who turned them down.
You guys ready to order?
I'll do the wood cider omelet, please.
On its surface, Bucks seems an unlikely venue for serious business. The dress code is dress down. A suit and a tie stand out here like a sore thumb. And the place is a riot of color, incited by an eclectic collection of, well, stuff hanging on the walls and from the ceiling.
Up here we have a chair used to train Ham the chimpanzee to go into outer space. And we have a Soviet spacesuit up there. I went to Russia to get that.
Also, a huge blimp, several stuffed fish, a Statue of Liberty with an ice cream sundae for a torch, and on one wall, a gigantic painting of Roy Rogers on trigger, rearing up. And then there's McNiven himself, decked out in custom-made screamingly loud shirts, irreverently seating his customers.
Gentlemen, can I get you a table? Here, well, sit down, shut up, and order the most expensive thing on the menu.
Oh, I can do that.
I'd like a nice fillet. The last fillets have been so bad, I'd like one that was edible this time. Oh, can you get me one that's edible?
We'll go open a can now.
McNiven's talents aside, it doesn't hurt that Bucks is only a few miles from Stanford University and the nation's biggest aggregation of venture capital firms on nearby Sand Hill Road. And then there's Woodside itself, horsey home to dozens of Silicon Valley gazillionaires. So how does McNiven know that things are looking up?
I noticed that one of my waitresses is driving a Bentley. I think that's a sign of good times.
Is that a fact? Not really, he says.
Yeah.
For NPR News, I'm John McChesney.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
I have a question.
Pancake? You get one. Make it a good one.
Pancakes or French toast?
Ooh, French toast. I like the raisin bread.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Michelle Norris, and we begin this hour with a sign of weakness in the economic recovery. The government reported today that the economy grew more slowly in the second quarter of this year than it did in the first. But in Michigan today, President Obama offered a spirited defense of his recovery program, especially the decision to bail out the domestic auto industry. Touring a pair of auto factories, the president said his controversial rescue of Chrysler and General Motors is beginning to pay off. As NPR's Scott Horsley reports, the U.S. auto industry has added some 55,000 jobs since the two companies emerged from bankruptcy last year.
Today's auto tour was a kind of victory lap for President Obama. He told workers at the Jefferson North Assembly Plant in Detroit he's always had a soft spot for Chrysler.
The first new car that I ever bought
was a Grand Cherokee.
Even as he fondly recalled that new car's smell, though, Mr. Obama said his Cherokee was no match for the 2011 model now in production at this plant. Chrysler just added a second shift here, hiring 1,100 additional workers. Standing in front of an unpainted Cherokee frame, Mr. Obama said those workers are proving wrong the naysayers who argued against his rescue of Chrysler and GM.
I wish they were standing here today. I wish they could see what I'm seeing in this plant and talk to the workers who are here taking pride in building a world-class vehicle. I don't think they'd be willing to look you in the eye and say that you were a bad investment.
One of those grateful workers is Daryl Ezell, whose job is installing doors on the new Cherokee. He's worked at Chrysler for about 15 years, but says his job would have been in jeopardy without the government's help.
Nothing like presidential leadership to step in and handle a very contentious situation that was the situation here in Detroit. I appreciate it. I mean, I owe my job to them, basically. We all owe our job to them.
Automakers' renewed hiring has barely put a dent in Michigan's unemployment rate, which still tops 13%. But Ron Blum, who helped lead the Treasury Department's auto task force, says without the Chrysler and GM rescues, at least a million more jobs would have been lost, and not just at those two companies.
This is an incredibly interdependent industry, and if GM had failed, a very large number of suppliers would have immediately failed, and that would have had a cascading effect through the balance of the industry, Ford included, and potentially others as well.
Instead, Blum says carmakers are slowly recovering. General Motors is expected to hold a public stock offering later this year. That could allow the government to recover most of its GM investment.
While there is still a long way to go, the companies are also showing positive signs of financial performance. In the first quarter, all of them made operating profits. So we think there's a lot of signs that while slow, the industry is truly coming back.
Mr. Obama also toured a General Motors plant where the Chevy Volt will be manufactured, and he took one of the plug-in hybrids for a spin. 9 GM factories were busy enough to work through their usual summer shutdowns this year, and Chrysler announced during the president's visit its plant in Sterling Heights, Michigan, will not close in 2012 as scheduled, but will instead stay open and hire additional workers next year. All of this leaves workers like Ezell feeling a little more optimistic.
Morale is very high now compared to what it was this time last year. It was kind of bleak, but got a good positive product. That's the main thing. Hopefully we can get some more shifts going on in here and return to prosperity and profitability.
And if they keep our wages, we might buy one too.
Ezell's co-worker, Katrina Brown Johnson, makes a good point. On the day the Commerce Department reported weaker than expected consumer spending, Americans' confidence in their own fortunes will determine the cars and other products they buy and their judgment on the steps President Obama has taken to steer the economy. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Detroit.
The homeless problem in Atlanta may soon get worse. The city's largest homeless shelter has been foreclosed on because the group running it is deep in debt. Some say the foreclosure is a conspiracy to rid downtown Atlanta of homeless men, while others claim the shelter is a steady source of crime and civic frustration. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, Susanna Capoluto reports.
About 100 homeless men and their advocates gathered in front of the Peachtree Pine Shelter on the edge of downtown Atlanta a few weeks ago to protest its foreclosure. The scene evoked memories of Atlanta's civil rights past as the Reverend Timothy McDonald vowed to fight for the shelter.
And we will not allow you to take away their home. We will stand to the very last drop.
The shelter does not turn anyone away. It holds about 400 people a night in the summer and 600 during the winter. But it's not easy living. The place has no hot water, no air conditioning, and no paid staff. The kitchen is inoperable, and food only comes when church members bring it in. The walls are cracked and in desperate need of a paint job. Amir Hussein has been here 3 weeks and is trying to leave.
But I got my clothes stolen in here and lost my money in, so I'm kind of stuck.
It contributes heavily to our crime rate.
Peggy Denby heads security for the nearby Midtown Neighborhood Association. She blames the shelter for petty crimes.
These men walk the streets all day, every day. Everything we have is at risk of being stolen or broken. They break into a huge number of cars.
Records show Atlanta police respond to the shelter almost daily for things like disorderly conduct or liquor law violations. The shelter's owner, the Task Force for the Homeless, has lost major donors over the years. Anita Beatty has led the task force for almost three decades. She says city and business leaders are conspiring against her. She's filed lawsuits charging they teamed up to cut off funding to the shelter. And that, she says, has forced her to run up a $900,000 debt.
For the last 15 years, the city worked day and night along with the business community to eliminate the presence of African-American men who are homeless from the streets of downtown.
City and business leaders would not comment for this story, citing the lawsuits, but they issued a statement saying they are concerned for the men at Peachtree Pine. Proteep Biswas heads the Regional Commission on Homelessness for Atlanta's United Way. His agency is pushing what's known as case management. It's a national trend in fighting homelessness and ties a shelter bed to social services. He says large shelters like this one are old-fashioned and make being homeless easy.
The philosophy of holding on to these men, sort of warehousing them, not letting the community come in and work with these men, is not an approach that I agree with.
But case management is expensive, and Biswas admits Metro Atlanta does not yet have enough shelter beds or affordable housing to help its estimated 7,000 homeless. Meanwhile, the city's largest homeless shelter continues to operate, waiting for a judge to decide whether the shelter's management can be evicted. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capoluto in Atlanta.
You're listening to All Things Considered.